Reconciliation there. Friends, I'm happy, always happy indeed, to welcome Neil O'Dowd, who is, among other things, of course, he is the founder and indeed the, well, let's just leave it at founded and produced the many of the sources of information that we rely on. Neil founded Irish Central, Irish American Magazine, Irish Voice newspaper, and indeed he has he's the author of several books. I have known Neil. Well, I've known him since I was a young lad, and he seems to be still holding together. You're very welcome there, Neil O'Dowd. How are you?
I wish I could say the same about you, you know.
Yeah. Oh, don't bother. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you learned to comb your hair yet?
Oh, stop it. Yeah. You would bring that up at this time? No.
Of course I would.
Yeah, oh, yeah. No, thanks. From what I hear, your own is nothing to brag about.
Well, I had my wife cut it, and it looks like a pudding bowl or something.
Oh, I know. I've resisted that temptation. The offer is there, but...
I'm sure it is. The offer didn't go the other way, by the way. We just cut hers.
I know. Books, of course. Books, that seems to be what you... you know, have really worked on through the years, in addition to, of course, publishing all of your, again, the Bible of information on Irish and Irish America here. But Lincoln and the Irish might be a good place to start, considering the time that's in it.
Yeah, I think that... I get a lot of comfort out of reading about Abraham Lincoln. Always did, because he's such an incredible figure. He makes you believe in America every time you read about him, that a man like him, with only 2 years of schooling, with no background in politics, a country lawyer who made it all the way to the White House and turned out to be, you know, probably America's greatest president by keeping the Republic together. So at times like this, when you see a lot of strife and strain and tension, you have to go back to Lincoln and his eye for justice and his sense of this is the right thing to do irrespective of what happens. Even if 600,000 people die, this is a republic, we're not going to be split. And I wish I could see some of that political determination today, but what you're seeing is a president who's frankly out of control with his tweeting, who has no idea how to make leadership work. And if you're looking at the best and the worst American presidents, in my opinion, you're looking at Lincoln and Trump. And I think you know which order I mean.
Mm, yeah. And, you know, when I arrived in the United States now some 60 years ago. I arrived sponsored by Paul O'Dwyer, who at the time... was, among other things, he had served in many areas and would serve as new president of New York City Council.
Right.
He would go on to become New York City ambassador to the United Nations. But I arrived assuming, first of all, from Ireland, we really... down in, particularly down the west of Ireland, Mayo, we didn't know that there was that much strife in the north of Ireland because it wasn't taught in schools. Somehow, Irish history stopped around 1916, and that was good enough. Again, coming into this family here, we didn't know that the issue of civil rights And Paul was champion of not only of civil rights in Northern Ireland, but also he was, you know, endeared himself to the Irish tremendously by marching down in Mississippi and civil rights marches and whatever. We, at that point, had, you know, as recent immigrants here, we had to wonder why the whole issue of racism, of civil rights, was so popular among particularly the Irish and Irish Americans here. And that was a cause to support and fight for. But who the hell cares about what Martin Luther King, what the, you know, what was going on down there? And we were very familiar with the category of down there. Down there was, you know, Mississippi had nothing to do with us. In Ireland,
sure,
for most of us, I have to say, admit, that up there, meaning the north of Ireland, was a place to stay away from. Don't have nothing to do with them. Can you explain why, and that atmosphere that the Irish in particular had their backs up, did not want a civil rights leader, didn't want an O'Dwyer, didn't want anyone.
You know, it's very interesting, Adrian, watching television the last week and seeing police in various states using plastic and rubber bullets and seeing Irish Americans, particularly in the White House, standing up and saying, that's great, keep doing it. And when you look at the record of plastic and rubber bullets in Northern Ireland, which almost every person in Ireland would have been familiar with, was a horrible history of killing people.
Hey, we lost you. Come on to the phone. All right. Go ahead.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can hear you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And you don't
I just make the point that civil rights is a universal struggle. So people like Paul O'Dwyer who exemplify for me the best of the Irish Americans. I'll never forget the night of David Dinkins been made mayor, that there was a sea of black faces at the reception up on the podium, and one big bob of white hair, and there he was, Paul O'Dwyer, the only white person on the stage with David Dinkins. And that said something very fundamental, that Paul understood better than any other Irish American that our struggle in Northern Ireland to reunite the country and the struggle of people for civil rights in America was linked very closely. And I think a lot of Irish Americans missed that connection. But I think if you're watching over the last few weeks, what you're seeing is a whole new generation of people coming out with a very different version of what we were doing back in the 60s and 70s. We were always told that this generation of young people were lazy, they wanted to watch Game Boy and play all these games. They weren't interested in politics or history. And then you look around the country and there's probably a million of them out in the streets between all the different venues. So it shows you that this thing doesn't go away. It just manifests itself in a different way. And what Paul was saying, as you said rightly, down in Mississippi, was what can be said again today, that Black Lives Matter. They didn't matter in Mississippi in the 60s, and there are people who think it's overwhelmingly the same case now. And certainly what happened to black people in recent months, people being shot, and of course the one where everyone's demonstrating. It's very, very difficult to look at the George Floyd case and separate it from struggles everywhere. And you're seeing this in the international arena with huge crowds in Dublin, London, Amsterdam, Paris, Germany. This is a universal issue of civil and human rights. There's a general feeling that most of the major countries, such as the United States, have gone way too far to the right. They're not caring for the minorities. I think this just came all together in one incredible moment about 2 weeks ago when Mr. Floyd was killed in that horrific manner. Suddenly everybody won't take this anymore. So I think it's Paul's struggles carried on 50, 60 years later. And I know that Paul will be one of the people who will be happiest to see this happen.
And Neil, just, I'd like to point out that in the midst of, say, our image throughout the world, it would appear that, you know, the same brush is used to paint, you know, all cops are racists.
Right.
All protesters are thugs, violence,
right.
You know. And if we could only get rid of the thugs and have the cops lie down or take being hit by bricks and everything, that the rest of us are doing very fine, thank you. Is that a continuation of a problem that has existed in America long before the civil rights movements of the 60s again?
Well, I think the easiest way to look at this, Adrian, is to look at how policing is handled in different countries. In the United States, the police are much more aggressive. In Ireland and Britain, they don't carry guns. Very, very few people get killed in cop shootings in Britain, Ireland, Europe. And the reason for that is the academies teach that they have to be on the defensive. They don't go on the offensive, that they try and de-escalate rather than escalate. Whereas what you have here in this country is a kind of a warrior mentality in many of these police forces, that we're in charge, we're the bosses, we can do whatever we want, get out of our way. And as in the case of George Floyd, I can actually kill a guy and look at you in the camera and not give a damn. I think that escalation issue is critical to everything. And it's because of guns, obviously, because you don't know when you pull someone over in this country whether that person might have a gun or something, whereas in Ireland or Britain, the chances of that would be very, very small. But I think the way cops are taught here has got to be retaught. I think that's a very fundamental issue, that you de-escalate conflict rather than escalate it, which is what has worked very successfully in other countries.
Isn't it just a bit like closing the gate after the horse is gone? In the sense that we could argue, of course, that because of the tradition of, again, policing in America, which didn't start anytime lately, okay, now we are stuck with there's no going back in terms of how that's going to work. But don't you think, though, that it's somewhat unfair to take people and, you know, our friends, our family, who are, again, great contributors as first responders. God knows we have, a great tradition in police and in the fire department, just about any of the areas where getting up in the morning present a problem when you go out the door and say so long. Maybe that's not so long. Maybe
right.
That's goodbye. How do you balance that? Taking today, never mind the, and I don't say never mind lightly, but knowing that policing in the United States is what it is, and obviously hasn't worked that great. Otherwise, we would see a different result. But
right.
how do you balance that with the fact that, and I have a feeling, that so much focus is on that on that aspect of police and police brutality and all of the, stuff that we see on television. That if somehow we got rid of all of that, that racism would take care of itself.
I do think that, and this is proved in Northern Ireland, that the most important person, and from the point of view of 99% of citizens, the only person that they'll ever come across from the federal government will be a policeman, their local policeman or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And if that local policeman is not to be trusted, as was the case in Northern Ireland, then it becomes impossible to have a legitimate political force or police force, which is exactly what happened with the RUC. Until that policeman is your friend rather than your enemy, you can't solve anything. And I think that's the problem we have in America, that so many neighborhoods still see the cops as enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do really think that an awful lot of the hype on television and the fact that there's so much social media is covering up the fact that, as you say, 99% of the cops were out there doing their job in very dangerous situations. You know, there were fears of being attacked. There was the COVID virus possibly floating around.
Yeah.
So you have to take your hat off to them and say, these are guys who are decent, honorable people going in doing a day's work and helping the country cope with a crisis. But there's no doubt that with cameras and with videos and with everything,
yeah,
some of these incidents that these bad cops get up to are highlighted much more than what happens with the other cops. But I think that over the years, you know, I think the cops are getting smarter, definitely. I mean, you don't really, given the fact that so many people marched, I don't know what the numbers is, but it must be in the millions, and that virtually nobody was injured or killed, is the ultimate proof that whatever people were doing was not the worst way to do it. Whereas if you were back in the 60s, in Paul's time, what they did was just basically, frankly, shoot the civil rights workers,
mm-hmm,
and with no compunction whatsoever. So I think it has improved. I do agree with you that, you know, you can't tar all cops with the same message as these guys who did this killing in Minneapolis. But I do think that policing remains at the heart of any society, because when you go out in the morning and you see something wrong, or you see a policeman, you want him to be your friend or her to be your friend. You don't want to look at him like the nationalists did look at the RUC, that there's the enemy, because that way you can't make policing work.
Neil, no stranger indeed to controversy, but when you wrote on Irish Central yesterday about why the Irish, should have a deep affinity with the black community and in fact contribute, do more to end racism, have we changed that much since the 60s, when there was a general feeling that all of this stuff, the civil rights and all the rest of it, had to do with us? What the hell are we sticking our nose into areas like the plight of blacks? And God forbid you would bring up any parallels or any any comparisons to the Irish struggle, like haven't we risen above that being the attitude, and we don't want to know about it?
No, I think you're right. I think there's an awful lot of Irish Americans who, particularly white suburban Irish Catholic voters, who think that they watch Fox all day and they think Trump is doing exactly the right thing. But I do think that the death of this particular man, George Floyd, really seemed to touch a nerve across every generation,
yeah,
every fault line, every group. I mean, even people on the far right could not but be disgusted at the inhumanity of the way that this poor man was killed. I think that was a teaching moment for everyone, that you're right, we didn't care too much in the 60s because it wasn't our fight. But now I think people will understand fully that in order to have a well-ordered society and a sane society, you do need police and people to be more able to communicate with each other. I think that starts at the very top, and I think that's the big failure of Donald Trump, who's taking on one side only. What you need is a president who can begin this process, and that it works its way down to even police boards and small town mayors, that the issue of the integration of black people into the police force, the issue of dealing with violence by the bad apples in the police, is much more understood and dealt with rather than the way it is now, which is every 6 months or so some unfortunate African American gets killed and there's an uproar and then it all fades away.
This time, obviously, is different, but can I just come back to your point about how the Irish should be not just on the sidelines here, but that they should indeed be there in support of the injustice, the black community. What is the central point there? And for those who are saying, I wish that O'Dowd and the rest of them would mind their own business, what is the point that that separates us as an ethnic group from, you know, everybody else? Why us?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, Irish and African Americans arrived in the worst shape possible. The Irish came on famine ships. The African Americans came on slave ships. And these were people at the very bottom of society after they arrived. And the Irish got their way out of the ghetto and managed to become middle class and upper class and eventually even end up in the White House for President Kennedy. The black people did not have the same rate of progression. And I think what the Irish didn't understand, well, I certainly didn't understand, is what 400 years of slavery did to the people, the black people in the South and elsewhere, that how, you know, how badly they were treated, how viciously they were, you know, kept captive all their lives, how they were worked to death, literally, how their kids were sold from underneath them. You know, it really is a horrific history of slavery that I personally did not count in enough when I was looking at this issue. That issue just keeps coming back to the whites in the South did their worst to keep the African Americans enslaved forever. And that memory is still very, very alive, not just in the South, but all over this country, and will always lead to the tension that we're seeing now, which is between blacks and whites on the issue of race. But I think it can get better. And although I have to say, after Barack Obama was elected, I thought that was a huge step forward. But in retrospect, it doesn't seem to have been, because what we witnessed with those policemen was a kind of racism that's very hard to understand. But I think your question is very complex. And the only way I can answer it is look at the example of Northern Ireland. It wasn't until the Unionists sat down with the Nationalists and the British sat down with the Irish and the Irish-Americans got involved and everybody sat around the same table and said, let's cut the rhetoric and let's just talk about doing a deal, which ended up in the Good Friday Agreement. I think that on a massive scale that has to happen in America in each community, where people sit down with the police, representatives of the community, that they understand the issues on both sides and that they do it from the grassroots up rather than from the top down.
You know, as an author and as a journalist, sometimes we associate you with that, and it is a privilege, you know, to be able to express not only your own feelings, but to take topics like we are dealing with, you know, and get it out there to be interpreted by whoever has an interest in it. But I'd like to bring it back to, you know, let's not skip over the Good Friday Agreement and the significance of, you know, a group, small group, five or six, including yourself, that went to Northern Ireland to sit down around the table to thrash out the differences and to see, in fact, what might be done. Most people felt, again, that, you know, those who represented here, you know, starting again with the Bill Flynns and the Bruce Morrisons and those who, you know, went to Northern Ireland, as you say, Mayo, had some cheek in terms of coming in uninvited, but got same people who were heading in the, you know, and continuing the tradition of being just divided, let's the hell with it, let it stay that way. But in sitting around the table, your own personal experience, how did that meeting come about, and can you bridge that first meeting to the point where there was implementation of the Good Friday Agreement?
Well, it was actually interesting this week. Friends of Sinn Féin had a podcast with Gerry Adams talking about the future and Joe Crowley. And Gerry was very interesting talking about that period you talk about. And he put it in the historical context right from the time of the famine onwards. Irish America had always been involved in the issue of Ireland right from the Fenian Rising on, when millions had left for America. And his point was that it was a progression. It was a slow progression, but as the years passed, Irish America didn't go away. It stayed there, even down in the times in the 40s and the 50s, when it was very little going on. And then, just through sheer coincidence and good luck, an American president got elected who was willing to look at the issue of Northern Ireland for the first time in the history of the presidency. Now, that didn't just happen. That happened because of all the years and all the generations and all the Paul O'Dwyer's and Frank Durkin's and all the people who stood up, kept the pressure on from outside. And that outside pressure was very significant, because you had a group of parties in Northern Ireland and two governments that were absolutely completely stalemated, and you needed to have an outside force come in. And that was the job we were doing. Was we were going in and we were saying to Sinn Féin, now, what would it take to stop the war? And people would look at us and say, oh, we can't stop the war. And we'd say, well, why? And they'd say, well, it's the war. It's against the Brits. And then you'd ask the question, well, how many Brits do you have to kill before you get a United Ireland? Was it 10 or 50 or 1,000? And on the other side, we had the unionists, who were totally anti-speaking to the nationalists, but were not against, funny enough, speaking to Irish Americans. And understanding that was a very critical part of our mission, that the unionists, guys like David Trimble, even though personally he wasn't likable, were actually prepared to be brave as well. And it was the understanding of that right across the spectrum that led to the Good Friday Agreement, that where George Mitchell said he knew he had succeeded when Martin McGuinness and David Trimble, or Ian Paisley rather, started exchanging photographs of their grandchildren. Because suddenly they were humanized. And it wasn't just Paisley, the evil Protestant who wanted to burn old Catholics, or McGuinness, you know, the terrorist leader of the IRA, but two human beings caught in a very human situation, men of their time who had the opportunity and the knowledge to make sure that this war did not go down into the next generation and beyond that. And I think that's true of all the peace processes around the world, and indeed of the process here, that the dehumanization of people, you know, that blacks are vandals and looters, all cops are crooked, all Irishmen are drunks, all Jews, you know, save their money, all blacks, you know, it just goes on, these stereotypes.
Yeah.
And I think what's the only way to deal with it is to get in at the very ground level, like we did in Ireland, and find out for real what's in people's hearts rather than the empty slogans.
It's the role of a referee, you know, in the sense that if there is conflict and if there is divide and there's no movement on that, that obviously somebody, some neutral force has to come and say, come on, let's sit down and work it out.
That's it, exactly.
And would, here is a rhetorical question, I'll throw it out there anyway, the Good Friday Agreement, could that have, was it heading in that direction or the opposite direction, were it not for President Clinton and his initiation of what would develop to be, again, the Belfast Good Friday Agreement?
Well, I think without Clinton, it definitely wouldn't have happened. Adams made that point in that podcast this week, that it was absolutely critical that Clinton become involved, because what you had was 200 years of the American government always taking the British position on Northern Ireland. Sure, they paid a little bit of attention to the Irish Americans, but nobody ever breached the White House. Nobody ever got in to talk to the president. And what happened was we got to this president, and Paul O'Dwyer was there as well, as he was in all those great efforts, and you were there too, Adrian. We got to Bill Clinton early, and we changed his mind on Ireland. Well, he didn't actually have a position, so we gave him a position on Ireland, which basically boiled down to, why not try and give it a chance to get peace? It's obvious from our research that there is a need and a feeling for peace, but it's just buried under all this antagonism. And it's funny, when I see the riots in America and all that, it comes back to the very same issue. People don't listen to each other, Adrian. People do not listen to each other. They do not listen to their political opponents. You look at the politics we have here today. But when you do stop and you do listen, great things can happen, because then there's an understanding.
Do things have to get, for instance, as they're experiencing now, do they have to get so out of control, so absolutely crazy, that a solution, however indirectly, has to come? Or can we expect, 10 years from now, that things are going to be pretty much the same? Is a change of government, and God knows Trump has highlighted a period of our own history here in the United States that at best is designed to be divisive. But what is it going to take post-Trump to put, Humpty Dumpty, to put it together again? Is as you see it, is that a long-range goal? It's not something that's going to happen, on day one, which is, of course, a great political slogan. On day one, right. I'm going to do this. Where do you see that?
Well, I see it in the election of Joe Biden, as kind of transitional figure to exactly what you're talking about. Joe Biden would be 78 on the day he's inaugurated, probably almost definitely a one-term president. We are in desperate need of somebody with the values and the conciliatory attitude that Biden has, certainly in terms of his own personal tragedies. He can be in the other person's shoes. He can understand. Trump cuts himself off from all contact with people who don't agree with him. But I would see Biden bringing in a lot of Republicans sitting around the table. And this may be just too, optimistic, but I do see something like that where, look, guys, this has gone far enough. The wars have been over for a long time. We need to get together and sit down. And, it can happen. I mean, if you look at Lincoln, go back to Lincoln again, the
right.
President before him was Buchanan, probably the worst president in the history of the United States, with the exception of Trump. And he was followed by Lincoln, this incredible political figure. So you don't know what will happen. So I think from that point of view, I think it's very likely, if there's a Democratic victory, that the process begins. I don't think it starts. I don't think it has started. But I think the country needs a healer. It needs a reconciler. It needs a person who can say, having a couple of Republicans in my cabinet would be a good idea, because it would reflect a higher percentage of Americans. Or a person who would go into black neighborhoods and say, I'm not here to lecture, I'm here to listen. I think those kind of things would make a huge difference. I mean, when you look at Trump during all the time of the COVID crisis, when he was on television, he never once brought up a person who was in the front line. He never once brought up a nurse or a health care provider. He was obsessed with bringing up all his rich business friends and all of them saying what a great president he was. He's not thinking about other people. He's thinking about himself. And I think what Biden would do it's changed that equation, that he would be thinking about the country first.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I noticed that one of the things you have always been good at is when you're on a roll, you drag me down with you. So
I'm happy to do that anytime.
Anytime. But the fact of the matter is that in addition to the leadership of Trump, that all almost to a person, all the Republicans have rolled over on this one, and it is disgraceful in that sense, in that nobody is going to stand up to Trump, and if they do, they'll get a tweet in the middle of the night that said they're not around anymore.
I know, it's an incredible reality to see this guy take over the party so totally, and even to the point where, you know, former President Bush makes a statement which looks very much like a repudiation of Trump, but it has no impact whatsoever on the followers. So you're looking at a very unique political figure who basically has a mini dictatorship within his own party where nobody will dare challenge him. But if the current opinion polls, and I say this with a lot of guarded talk, if the current opinion polls are anything like true, which show Biden up about 10 points, the closer you get to the election, the more you're going to see Republicans saying, well, am I going to go down with this ship, or am I going to try and save myself and turn against this guy? And that will be one of the fascinating dynamics of the next 6-5 months before the election. Exactly what will all the Republicans do if Trump starts to, or continues to go down in the polls?
Neil, final question. Is there enough time now that there are so many between the, obviously, the coronavirus has, COVID-19 has not gone away. Obviously, the protests and the civil unrest is not going to go away anytime soon. So, whereas you have presented a wish list of, again, having somewhat of, if not a revolution, a total resistance, say, of Republicans to Trump. First of all, is there enough time left? And secondly, is all of this dependent on the polls as to whether, you know, how far does Trump have to go down before we see that change? And is there enough time? We're talking about a few months.
Yeah, I think it can happen pretty quickly if you're running for an election. People don't really get into it until Labor Day, Adrian. And, you know, by then you'll have another couple of months of summer and you'll see where the unemployment figures or where the problems that Trump has been suffering from. But I do think one thing that a second term of Trump should make a lot of Republicans reconsider, because he's exposing himself as a dictator who wants to have full military power, who wants to fire whoever he wants, who wants to appoint attorney generals who speak only for him. That's not just bad for America, it's bad for the Republican Party to have people who are so extreme in positions of power. So I think they have a huge question to answer. What is the future of their party, with Trump or without Trump? Because they have hitched their wagon, as you say, so firmly to this guy that they will experience every up and down, every setback over the next 6 months that could cost them not just the White House, but the Senate and the House. Mm. And I remain hopeful, but, you know, the last time you and I were talking, when there was a presidential election, which was years ago, you know, we just assumed Hillary was going to win. So you can never tell the American public where their hearts will be.
Neil, thank you. And
thank you.
You're insightful. Indeed, contribution is something which you may not have everybody in your corner, but you sure as hell do have a lot of people in the midst of all this confusion. Maybe think again and look at it from a different viewpoint. Thank you, Neil.
Thank you very much, Adrian. I appreciate being on.
Okay, thank you. Friends, Neil O'Dowd there. I mentioned, you know, a few areas where Neil has had tremendous influence, again, in addition to founding Irish Central, Irish American Magazine, Irish Voice newspaper. And his books, which include An Irish Voice, Lincoln and the Irish in New Ireland, Fire in the Morning. You can again, friends, link on to our website, and we'll connect you also directly or indirectly with Neil O'Dowd. Friends, again, we do not indeed in any way pretend that we have any opinions with respect to, I shouldn't say opinions because yes we do, but there are any solutions in sight. But this being an Irish program, let's find out what is happening in Ireland.